Hi, this is Willie Wilson. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. The grand jury investigating the shooting of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson will be announcing their results any day now. On today's broadcast, we look into what a grand jury is, how it is conducted, and why it is used in place of the prosecutor's office deciding to indict or not. Host Keith Brownell talks with attorney David Bell about grand juries. And later in the show, we open the phone lines so you can ask your questions. Have your pen and paper ready for our calendar of events, and as always, the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Now, let's hear from Keith and David.
The United States is the only common law jurisdiction in the world that continues to use the grand jury process to screen indictments. And while all states in the U.S. have provisions in their laws for grand juries, less than half the states in the U.S. still use the grand jury process. Missouri is one of those that does. The recent killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri by a police officer, Darren Wilson, has raised serious questions about the integrity of the grand jury process and the impartiality of St. Louis prosecutor Bob McCullough. My name is Keith Brownell, and on today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, we will be discussing the procedures used in grand jury proceedings with local attorney David Bell. We are also inviting our listeners to call in to participate with their comments and questions. The number is 816-931-5534. Good morning, Mr. Bell, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please give us a little personal background about yourself.
Sure. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I practice in the state of Missouri and the state of Kansas, as well as federal courts. I've prepared witnesses for grand juries at the state level and the federal level as well, in addition to, frankly, law enforcement personnel.
Could you give us a little history on the background of the subject?
Sure. So the grand juries have been around for a long time, almost 800 years. The Magna Carta, I think, first included within that a grand jury procedure. And here's the basic issue. If you have the king, if you will, or a dictator, and that dictator wishes to bring charges against someone, criminal charges that could bring serious consequences, jail time or even the death penalty, people at some point, when they started to assert their rights, wanted there to be some buffer between the penalty, if you will, and between the crown making the charge. And so the idea of grand juries came into being. And the point of it, at least originally, was that if the king wished to bring a charge against somebody, that charge, the evidence, would be presented to a grand jury or to a group of citizens, and those citizens would then decide if the charge should proceed forward. That has been incorporated. It came over from England. It's been incorporated into our Constitution in the Fifth Amendment. And so grand juries are written into our founding document. And again, the original, I think, point of it was to have a group of citizens make a decision if the charge and prosecution by the executive branch should continue forward to a trial.
What is the difference between a grand jury and a regular trial court jury?
Sure. So a grand jury is there just to decide if a charge should go forward through the court system against a particular person. It is a different standard, a lower standard. It requires only probable cause, which generally means, is it more likely than not that a crime was committed, and was the person we're talking about the one that committed that crime? That's essentially probable cause. For a regular, we're calling a regular jury trial that you see on TV, that requires beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to leave the jurors, the state does, or the federal government has to leave the jurors firmly convinced of a person's guilt before they can be found guilty. So just to be clear, we have grand juries that have to decide, is it more likely than not that this person committed a crime? And then we have what I'll call the regular juries that we see on TV that have to make a determination if, as the prosecutor firmly convinced me of the person's guilt. And one final thing, with the grand juries, it does not have to be unanimous. So grand juries generally can either 2/3 or 3/4 of the grand jurors, whereas in criminal trials, it generally has to be a unanimous verdict.
why do prosecutors use grand juries instead of preliminary hearings?
Sure. And so, and let's talk briefly about the preliminary hearings as well. In the state of Missouri, which is, it would be a great example, you can be arrested on a complaint and a warrant that's filed with the court. The judge would have to sign off on it. Someone's taken into custody. The judge has signed the warrant based upon information that he or she has read or been told. At some point, the system wants to have a check on that. The system says, listen, I took your word for it, prosecutor, police officer, show me some evidence. In Missouri, the prosecutor then has the opportunity to go one of two routes. They can either go to the grand jury, which we've talked about very briefly, and they can also go to a preliminary hearing. The difference between the two is the preliminary hearing is an open court, and you get to see the witnesses, meaning any of the public can come. The standards is the same, but it's all in the open. And so the difference between the two is one is in the open, if you will, and one is not in the open. Now, why would a prosecutor want to do that? I can only tell you from a defense attorney looking into the system that I've been a part of for a while as to why I think they may do it. In some cases, if there's a sensitive subject or if it's going to be a considerable period of time, over time, that evidence will need to be presented, that may be a reason why you'd want to have a grand jury rather than a preliminary hearing. So in some cases, grand juries are impaneled for a period of time, months, and evidence may be heard, you know, every few days for a few weeks, for a few months before a decision is rendered. That would be very difficult to do in a preliminary hearing. The other thing that I would, that the grand jury, I think, provides the prosecutor is a little more control as to what evidence is presented. And then, of course, finally, at least as it comes to mind as a defense attorney, in the grand jury, I'm not allowed in. I'm not allowed to cross-examine witnesses. Preliminary hearing, I am allowed. Generally, it's limited, but I am allowed to cross-examine the witnesses that are presented against my client.
Once again, I'd like to inform our listeners that this is a call-in show, and you can contact us at 816-931-5534. 861-931-5534. In regards to what you just commented on a while ago, is it true that prosecutors can pretty much determine the outcome of a criminal case by the use of a grand jury?
Well, I think, having never presented evidence at a grand jury because I'm not allowed in, that's a little bit difficult for me to answer. I will tell you generally that because a prosecutor usually can craft the scope of the evidence that will be presented, that I assume that ability is there. However, the grand jury is made up of citizens of the county. And so if the citizens want more evidence or the citizens disagree with the prosecutor, I think they won't have any problem telling the prosecutor that. And so that's kind of the check on the system. Again, we have the prosecutor who would maybe go ahead and want to charge someone or not charge someone, who first has to present evidence to a grand jury, a group of citizens, and those citizens ultimately make that decision. However, again, the prosecutor has the ability to perhaps create the parameters of the evidence being introduced, and that possibly could influence a grand jury's decision.
When the selection process for the grand juries are being used, is this the same process that's used to select normal jurors?
In the state of Missouri, the answer is yes, it is the state. In fact, the grand jury, the statute for grand juries in the state of Missouri references the selection process for what I'm calling regular juries.
And what is that process?
I believe the process requires a list to be generated from two or three public rolls that are kept, voting rolls, property tax rolls. I don't know the third, but some public list of citizens that are then selected at random.
Oh, okay. Now, what people are qualified to be in jury selection processes and those that are prohibited?
Well, that's going to vary based upon the state. I don't know, for example, if a grand jury, if they would be subject to the same qualifications as a jury. However, it seems like they probably would. And so in some states, for example, persons convicted of felonies are not allowed. In others, another situation would be individuals that aren't paying their property tax, aren't registered to vote, that aren't fully participating in society. For whatever reason, those individuals may be excluded from the rolls.
Caller, you're on air.
Yes, this is Jeff. I'm in Midtown. And I do have a question My understanding is that, of course, the prosecuting attorney is the one that's presenting the case to the grand jury. But the grand jury also, I believe, has the right to tell the prosecutor, we want you out of the room. We want to ask some questions of this witness ourselves because we feel that your presence is inhibiting their testimony. Is that really the case, or you know, how come people on the grand jury actually, get the questions asked that they feel are necessary?
So again, and this is based upon I've sat outside the grand jury room in both the state and federal system, but I've never been in it. I mean, I've looked in, I guess, but I've never physically been in it. First of all, let me say that my understanding of it and what I've seen and also heard secondhand is that it's much more of a relaxed environment in the grand jury than it is in the regular jury system. And so individuals are able to throw out questions of whatever nature they want, I guess, within some scope. And so it would be my impression from what I've heard. And, you know, I recall in one particular case where I was outside, I had prepared a witness for a grand jury, and I was outside, and we eventually saw the grand jurors come out, and it was a contentious case. And I remember there were tears. There were people with angry looks on their face. There were people that were walking quickly out the door. It appeared to me, at least in this kind of anecdotal situation, that the individuals took their job very seriously. In addition, the deliberations themselves are secret in that I believe during the deliberations themselves, both the judge, to the extent a judge would be involved, or the prosecutor who's presenting evidence, has to leave. So the grand jurors sit around and make the decision as to whether to issue a true bill or an indictment or a no true bill.
Are defense attorneys allowed to be present during the selection of grand juries?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, so there's no way to ensure that the jurors are being selected fairly and impartially because it's just simply being done by the prosecutor and no one's around to monitor his behavior.
Well, I would say, in, for example, the state of Missouri, that it says the jury list shall be the result of a random selection of names from a minimum of two government records, including but not limited to personal property tax list, voter registration list, and driver's license records. And so as to who is going to put that together, who is going to make that selection, I have not been part of that process.
Is there anything in the law that indicates who should make that selection?
No, other than the statutes that have been provided, that would be a group of individuals from that list.
So if a prosecutor just went out and he got 10 of his neighbors or 10 of his relatives or someone and he brought them in to participate in the grand jury, there's nothing that would... there's no way to verify that or check, monitor.
I don't believe that the prosecutor is in charge of gathering and selecting the grand jurors. I believe that's independent of the prosecutor.
Oh, okay. Once again, our call-in number is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. If you have comments or questions, you can call in and talk with our guest today about the grand jury process as it exists in the state of Missouri. Why do you think that less than half of the states still use grand jury proceedings?
I think that, well, there's a few reasons. One, I think grand juries can be somewhat onerous for individuals. Grand juries don't meet generally for one issue or one case. The involvement I've had with them, they meet over a significant period of time. They have to come a few days during a month, every month for a few months. I think that can be difficult. So I think a lot of it is just the cost and the time of putting it together.
Well, do you think it could also be an acknowledgement that by most states and the rest of the world that the grand jury process is seriously flawed?
Well, I guess my question back to you, Keith, would be how do you believe it's flawed? Is it the secrecy aspect of it, or what would you?
Well, it seems that the states that still use the grand jury process, they, you know, seem to prefer that over having the proceedings in open court. And I think anything that's conducted in privacy is subject to suspicion.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. And so the issue, though, is how, what's the best way to present a charge? So what generally happens, just in the prosecution, the best cases I've ever won are cases that have never been filed. So if you can get it, a case, get it on an investigation before it's charged, before it's presented to a grand jury, you're in a much better situation. Once you've been charged with a crime, your stress level, I'm talking about the client, the defendant, your stress level, the costs, the disruption to the family, that goes through the roof, okay? As a result of that, there has to be some check on the ability of the prosecutor to just file a charge. One other option would be to have no grand jury or no preliminary hearing and just let the prosecutor immediately file a charge. Now, that happens, I guess, presumably in misdemeanors a lot of times where you just file with what's called an information. Or you could have a defendant just show up and agree to be charged by information. I suppose that's an alternative. I think the case you're talking about, Keith, and I think as we get back to the St. Louis County case, is does a prosecutor or would a prosecutor use the grand jury process to bury a case, if you will, or not charge a case? Mm-hmm. That's really the issue. So let's say a prosecutor has a contentious case and the prosecutor doesn't know what to do and or doesn't want to charge it and therefore wants to put that responsibility for not charging it on someone else, some other group. I think that's the case we're talking about here. Does that happen? I believe it does. But at the end of the day, it's a grand jurors and presumably that it's the Board of Jury Commissioners, I think, that puts the list together in the state of Missouri. If assuming that process is okay, at the end of the day, you have a group of citizens who are making that ultimate decision as whether this officer in this case should be charged or should not be charged with a crime.
And how many people did you say are used in a grand jury proceeding?
And it's going to depend based from state to state and based on the federal. I think, let's say, between 12 and 23 jurors, I know in the state of Missouri versus the feds. And I think the state of Missouri requires 9 of 12 to vote in favor of an indictment. And in the federal system, it requires 12 of 16, like a quorum of 16, in order for the grand jury to work. So you've got two-thirds, three-quarters of the individuals to vote in favor of it to have it go forward. Again, one of the problems we're having here is I see this as I read the news, as I watch TV on this issue, as I get on the Internet and look around, is you have individuals that feel that they are not being able to be part of the system, and so the system then becomes this kind of unknown and almost secretive device for bringing a lot of pain and suffering to individuals. And because then you have the anger that builds up and we get to a situation like this. If you want to learn about, and I'm talking to the listeners here, if you want to learn about the grand jury process, you can read the statutes. If you want to get involved in it, you get involved in government. And if you want to change it, then let's change it. But so far, I have not seen, and believe me, I've been angered myself at some of the decisions that have come out of grand juries, but I don't know of a better system at this point in which to how to deal with it.
Well, you don't think that the preliminary hearing process is a better system than the grand jury process where you have everything out in the open?
Well, that's a great question. I will tell you that in cases where I want to win, well, let me rephrase that. I want to win in every case. In cases where I know there's a chance of winning, I would rather have it at the preliminary hearing than otherwise. So a witness is not going to show or something like that. In a case where I know I'm going to lose at the preliminary hearing because the standard is so low, it's more likely than not. Sometimes I don't know. I don't know if I want a preliminary hearing or a grand jury. Generally, of course, you want to see the evidence that the prosecutor has, but in the state of Missouri and in the feds, I'm allowed to see that evidence at some point before trial. Perhaps a middle ground that Jed, I ask you to consider is what if the state of Missouri required, and I don't think I've ever seen one in the state of Missouri, I have it the feds, what if the state of Missouri required a record to be kept of the grand jury proceedings, including a transcript and including a log of all the evidence presented, and that at some point that became publicly available, then there could be a check on the system from the public. It would get you somewhere between a preliminary hearing and the grand jury that we have.
That was my next question. Is there any process through which can be used to challenge a grand jury indictment? Do you have a way that you can gain access to the records or challenge the process, or is it just a case where they walk in and they hand you a piece of paper and say, well, you've been indicted and, you know, there's nothing you can do about it?
So, okay, and again, the way that we challenge an indictment is by going to trial. So again, the indictment is the first stage. It's almost a validation of what law enforcement, the prosecutors originally did, but it's not the final stage. If I want to challenge a grand jury indictment, and I want the public to hear about it, and I want them to see all the evidence that I've got in favor of my client, and I want the public to see me cross-examine or run up the rear end of some witness that the government had, then we can just go to jury trial. And that jury trial is going to be public. Anybody that wants to can come in and see it. You can sit through the whole thing if you want to and watch it from beginning to end. That's the way our system, it challenges it. I think what you're talking about here, Keith, and what I think there's a lot of anger is the concern is this prosecutor in this particular case is using the grand jury to make sure this officer does not get charged. So he's going to use the grand jury process to tank his own case. That's what the concern is here. Because remember, usually I'm on the other side of this. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I'm hoping they don't get indicted. That's what I usually want. But the concern here is the prosecutor is using this system to, number one, make it secret so no one sees the evidence presented, and number two, make sure that the grand jury returns something that does not return an indictment. I would think in this case, assuming you have a reasonable representation of the community at large in the grand jury, this will be a very contentious, very, very contentious grand jury. In my opinion, I don't know who's serving on it, but I can just tell you based on prior experience that generally jurors and grand jurors take their responsibilities very seriously. So the idea of just a rubber stamp in there, I don't think is accurate.
When I was in paralegal studies, our instructor told us that the best time to beat a case is before you're even charged with a crime.
Correct.
And the second best time to beat it is before you even go to trial.
Correct.
So I would assume that most attorneys would want to have a process that they can even prevent a case from even going to trial. If they have to, I wouldn't think that they would prefer to have somebody walk in and hand them an indictment and say, okay, now if you want to challenge this, let's go to trial. And the second thing is that it seems like in these cases where you have police officers who have committed shootings against suspects, that the prosecutors almost always opt to go to a grand jury rather than have the case aired out in public at a preliminary hearing.
That has been my experience, yes.
So I guess this, you know, what you just told me a while ago is an acknowledgement that there can be a miscarriage of justice and it's more common in grand juries than in preliminary hearings.
Well, when you're talking about miscarriage of justice, again, from a criminal defense standpoint, the miscarriage of justice I've seen is when a case has been bound over for trial, meaning that the judge has found probable cause when I didn't think there was any to find, because mm-hmm. I'm representing the criminal defendant here. Mm-hmm. The question that you're raising is as follows, I think. Is it more likely that the same evidence presented at a grand jury, let me rephrase that, assuming the same set of evidence, if you present that same evidence at a grand jury and you present it at a preliminary hearing in public in front of a judge, is one avenue more likely to return a charge? I think that's the question. Is that right?
Yeah, I've heard this expression used quite often that, you know, some grand juries will indict a ham sandwich. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to get at. Do you have grand juries that will just simply indict a person regardless of what the circumstances is in the case? And I think if Darren Wilson is not indicted, this would be the reverse of that. I would have to assume that given the evidence has already been aired in the public media, this would be a grand jury that would just say, well, we are not going to indict this police officer. We don't care what the circumstances is.
I see. So I think I understand what you're saying, Keith. And if grand juries can be, you know, used, or the saying is to indict a ham sandwich, then it would seem to be very clear that in this case, that when you have a individual who is dead in the street in a situation where there are some factual disputes, that this officer would be indicted. And therefore, if he's not indicted, then it would suggest that there's some corruption with the system. I think is that what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, generally in grand juries, the other topic to bring up is that the defense usually is not able to present their side of it. Remember, I'm not allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, neither is my client. Now, in some cases, we can be invited in by the prosecutor. And I will tell you that in this particular case, that the officer was invited in to testify, and he gave, I think, like 4 hours of testimony to the grand jury. And so that in and of itself would make this unusual relative to other grand jury proceedings that I've been a part of.
This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I'm interviewing Attorney David Bell about the process used in grand jury proceedings on today's show. At this time, we're going to pause for our calendar of events, and then we'll resume the interview.
Now, the calendar of events for October 20, 2014. The quarterly homelessness task force meeting will be Friday, October 24th, from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at the Mid-America Regional Council offices, 600 Broadway, Suite 200, KCMO. This meeting will be full of updates on the mayor's challenge to end veteran homelessness, the Children and Youth's investment plan, and more. For more information, you can contact the MARC offices at 816-474-4240. Blue Hills Community Services is holding a Family Computer Day, Wednesday, October 22nd, from 1 to 3 p.m. at their offices, 5008 Prospect, KCMO. You are invited to learn or improve your computer skills, such as email, safely surfing the web for information or entertainment, and more. There will be refurbished desktop and laptop computers for sale to participants with a picture ID plus documentation of state or federal assistance or unemployment. You must register as slots are limited. Please call Leigh Blumenthal at 816-333-7870, extension 203, or email her at Leigh, and that's capital L-E-I-G-H, at bhcsmo.org. The Electrical Workers Minority Caucus of IBEW Local 124 and the KCMO chapter of NAACP are sponsoring the fourth annual Skilled Trades Forum for those who are looking to enter a career in the building, construction trades, and more. The forum will be held Saturday, October 25th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd Street, KCMO. Representatives of many construction union apprenticeship programs will be available with applications and information. Male and female high school seniors, recent graduates, and veterans are especially encouraged to participate. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
We're back again on Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I have as my guest Mr. David Bell. We're talking about the grand jury process in the state of Missouri, and we're inviting our listeners to call in at 816-931-5534. That is 816-931-5534. Mr. Bell, I wanted to ask you before we went to the break, can a person a grand jury failed to indict still be charged with a crime and brought to trial?
The answer is yes. I think where we may see this, or at least the possibility of this, is if the state of Missouri, or if the local grand jury fails to indict, there can also be a federal prosecution, possibly. Also, I believe if additional evidence is discovered, that a grand jury can be repaneled to hear the Missouri case as well.
Caller, you're on air.
Yes. I just like to relate my experience being on criminal juries. Usually what I find is in the deliberation phase when you're with the other jurors, if you try and bring up something, you know, to try and make sense of the case that was presented before you, and if you suggest that What if the officer or the prosecutor may be bending certain things or misrepresenting or even lying? And there'll always be a number of people on the jury who will go, you can't do that. I mean, people are very compliant. They want to believe what they're told, and that just seems, and occasionally, and usually you'll get, you know, people on the jury that will go, yeah, that kind of makes sense if you look at it that way. It makes certain other things fit. But, you know, in my case, I'm usually the only one left standing with that position that, you know, that makes sense. And the other people that are initially agreeing with me, you know, the browbeating, the pressure, it's just, you know, that's what we're up against.
And caller, let me, this is David, let me address that briefly. You know, when I leave a courtroom or I leave my office at the end of the day, I drive in my car, I go home to my family in a home, I'm a part of society. And so at some level, I want the system to work. I want to have faith in the system. At the same time, as a criminal defense attorney, my job is to test that system on an ongoing basis. And so I think the struggle you're talking about may be part of that. Now, to the extent that the prosecutor or a police officer has done something wrong and that I'm able to find out about that, it's my job as a criminal defense attorney to present that to the jury at trial. The jury trial is the ultimate, to me at least, is ultimately where justice happens or doesn't happen, but it's the best place that I'm able usually to get it in a really strongly contested case. Because at the end of the day, the jurors are alone. They're up there. They get to make the decision. It's one person, one vote. Doesn't matter who your father is or what job you have or your skin color. You can't convict unless it's unanimous. And that's, to me, is the ultimately where our system rests. Now, we're talking about procedures and processes leading up to that system.
Caller, we didn't get your name and part of town you're calling from. Are you still on
from
there?
From Prairie Village. Thank you.
Prairie Village. Okay. Mr. Bell, I had a question that came to my mind while you were speaking a while ago. Now, you said that that these cases don't revolve around who your father is or where you live and, you know, what color you are, but clearly there are some instances that call the racial question about into the situation. You know, like I just recall reading a poll that was on the internet the other day where they said that 62% of white Americans feel that the situation in Ferguson, that the officer was justified in using deadly force
right
against the black suspect. And I think it was 90% of the African-American population that felt that the force was unjustified. Now, do you feel that in grand jury proceedings it would be helpful if evidence that gave any indication to a person's racial identity, it would be helpful if that was excluded from the process, from the grand jury process?
Meaning if you would, so that we wouldn't know if the officer in this case was Caucasian or if the victim in the case was black?
Exactly.
It would be interesting experiment to see. I don't know how it would be possible practically to do that in cases where you have videotape or you have testimony and things like that. By the way, my comment about who your father is, mm-hmm. the color of your skin, I was talking about the grand jurors themselves. The issue you brought up with that poll goes to whether or not race still matters in terms of how we view our position in society and how we view others' position in society. And the answer is absolutely it matters. It matters because my experience with the police as a citizen have been remarkably different than a lot of my clients have as criminal defendants. And so as a result of that, and a result of these other individuals, they see Ferguson, they're going to see it through the lens that they've created by their own experiences, their own prejudices, their own biases. So if you've had a bad experience with a police officer, then I think you're more likely to view the Ferguson situation from a standpoint of the police officer did something wrong. If your experience with the police has been somewhat positive or at least not negative, then you're going to view it from a completely opposite perspective.
Our call-in number is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
You know, going back to that, the situation, and you and I talked, Keith, before we started the show, you know, at the end of the day here, you've got, regardless of what happened in the heat of the moment, because I'm not sure we'll ever know that, but we have a young man walking in the middle of the street who's dead. Okay, that's, at the end of the day, we've got that. And so should officer contact at that point wind up in that situation? Obviously, as a society, the answer that we would like to say is no, we don't want that to happen. So the question is, for me, how do we prevent those situations? How do we prevent a situation where that occurs? And you and I had this conversation before, and I think this is a more heated discussion, as to what do we do? You know, one thing I would like to see, frankly, is the ability, law enforcement, to be trained more so in conflict resolution without weapons. You know, I've survived now 42 years in a number of different situations. I don't put myself in the same situation as law enforcement on a daily basis, minute by minute. I get that. But somehow I've been able to survive 42 years without having to pull a gun on somebody. Is it possible that law enforcement receiving more training on how to with conflict resolution without weapon would be a benefit in the situation? And you and I talked about, I guarantee that you have to qualify every few months on your weapon to carry a sidearm, but I don't know if that same qualifications exist to be able to deflate a situation that's going to escalate and go out of control.
Well, it seems to me that the emphasis in society now is making sure that the officer is always in a position where he feels safe. And I think there's an exaggerated impression that's being conveyed to society that the slightest little movement that a person makes, any type of non-compliant comment, it just automatically justifies an officer shooting somebody or killing them if that results. Now, is that your perspective on that situation?
Well, I have a slightly different one. You know, I grew up in mean streets of Johnson County, Kansas. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's where my experience is from. Mm-hmm. And my bad experience with law enforcement is that the officer not having the particular baseball card that I wanted at the time I went up and asked him for it as a kid. That's a much different experience than a lot of individuals I've represented. I will tell you, though, that when an officer lights me up when I'm driving, whether I think I was speeding or not, I pull over, I take my keys, I turn my ignition off, I put my keys on the dashboard, and I put my hands on the steering wheel. Now, do I talk back to the officer when he comes up? Absolutely not. But, again, I'm coming at it from a different perspective. I don't know, in this situation, how that occurred, if there were words exchanged. I just don't do it. I'm not going to fight with the officer. If the officer does something wrong to me, or I feel the officer was unfair to me, or in particular a client is usually where I have this, I have no problem working within the system to try to get that officer either disciplined or to bring that out in open court so the court of public opinion can come into play on.
Well, I've been pulled over by police officers myself, and I automatically know from my experience and out of the paranoia that I have in being in situations like that talking back to police officers is not the best thing to do when you're in a traffic situation. But there is this thing that they call road rage.
Right.
And police officers are not the only ones who get talked bad to in situations like that. You have people that drive down the street all the time. You know, they feel like you should have moved over and let them pass, or you should have tried to beat the light when you were at the corner. And, you know, they say a lot of nasty things to you. I'm saying it's just something that, you know, you learn to respect. I don't talk back to police officers in those type of situations. When somebody rides by in a car and they say something to me, I just let them go ahead, because for all I know, they could have a gun in the car,
right,
or something. And I think that's where a lot of the times you have homicides that take place and they don't know what the cause of them are. But I don't, at the same time, I don't feel like because you say something to a police officer that he doesn't like, that's justification for you whooping out your pistol and killing him.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think, to a certain extent, an officer's ability, and I don't know in this situation, but an officer's ability to defuse the situation, as we all have to do in society, to defuse the situation without a weapon, is extremely beneficial. The best officers, whether it's federal agents or local ones, are the ones that are confident with themselves, the ones that don't take personal offense to comments that you're talking about, and that are able to diffuse the situation and be reasonable. And by the way, if officers do that, my clients are, you know, they're out of luck on their case completely. Criminal, whatever. If officers reasonable, they're being videotaped, presumably, or microphone, and they're giving the individual a number of opportunities to comply, and the individual makes a decision not to. Again, I talked about this on the last show I was at. If you're pulled over by an officer or you're stopped by an officer or an officer comes up to you on the street, that is not the time to get into a constitutional debate about whether or not the officer has the right to do that. It's not the time.
I agree.
You need to comply and then to go forward. Now, if the officer does something you don't like, you need to immediately go to the sergeant or go to the headquarters of that law enforcement, make a complaint. Obviously, you might not think that's effective, and go get an attorney or go to the newspaper or go wherever you want. But the debate on the street at that moment is not where it's going to get resolved, and it's going to lead to bad things. Now, should the officer at some point pull a gun in that type of situation? I haven't been in that situation, so it's difficult for me to say. However, it would seem to me that noncompliance by an individual who is stopped for speeding or stopped for a traffic offense or even jaywalking, and there's no other indication of anything else going on, for that to lead to violence is distressing to me. And I would like to see other methods of dealing with that situation, if possible, that would not involve pulling a gun. Or, frankly, if the individual is not going to comply, that the officer has other methods of dealing with that person. For example, getting a picture of that person using the dash cam or the point of view camera that officers wear, and going to the court, having a warrant issued for that individual for whatever crime they've committed by not complying with the police officer, having that person arrested and having them punished for that behavior.
Well, I think most people assume that the presence of someone in uniform is some type of assurance that this person has more discipline and tolerance in a situation, that he's better trained to deal with situations where people get involved in heated discussions. And another thing, there's always this, you know, you hear people say this all the time, you know, don't dispute or don't debate with the officer about what your rights are and all that, you know, just go get a lawyer. Now, everybody's not in a position where they can afford to have a lawyer, to hire an attorney, because their rights are violated. And a lot of times I think a lot of these arguments and debates with attorneys, police officers, are because people are trying to avoid having to be placed in a situation where they have to hire an attorney, because if they don't have the means, and whatever happens or whatever takes place here at this situation, it's pretty much going to be the end of it. So they are involved in trying to convince the officer that if you care anything about the law, if the law means anything to you, this is what it says, and you are violating the law.
And Keith, that makes a lot of sense. And what you're suggesting here is, you know, for me, if I get a ticket or something happens to me, I get arrested, whatever it may be, I know an attorney right away I can call. I've got the means to do it. I think for some individuals, what you're saying is if they don't, they want to try to resolve it at that moment. Assuming that's not going to happen, is there an outlet for individuals to resolve it without the money for attorney? There is the Office of Citizen Complaints for Kansas City, Missouri. I know I've talked to individuals there. And if that doesn't work, then I think you have to go to your elected official.
We have a caller. Would you please tell us where you're from and what your name is?
Yeah, I'm from Wyandotte County.
Okay.
And I'm Bill.
Okay, Bill, how are you?
And I want to make one more qualification. I am of African descent, and which really makes a big difference in the course of this conversation as it goes along. And as seems to be some people are skirting around, there's been an interesting choice of words. I'll get to that later, but I've served on several juries over here in Wyandotte County, and what your previous caller described is that's pretty much the way it goes. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be pretty much like human nature in small group dynamics. A dominant person will say some crazy stuff and just browbeat other people, and they just simply go along because, after all, they're making a verdict over someone's life that isn't theirs. Or anyone they know, so they generally don't care. And just a comment, another real comment. The stressing is when your car doesn't start. the battery's dead or you have a cold. The choice of word was kind of weird.
Choice of word in what way?
I think that when people are harassed and pretty much been terrorized for a decade, and for that matter, centuries in this culture, that to actually believe that there is any measure of justice that can be meted out from people that have basically shown in subtle ways and overt ways that they're not your friend and they have no desire to see you advance in the culture or your children advance, I think that it's kind of weird to actually expect any measure of justice from a grand jury.
Caller, this is David real quick. I agree to a certain extent with you, but I guess my question back to you is, so what do you want to do? Meaning, what's your alternative? I agree that there's absolutely racial prejudice in the system, but what's your alternative?
To what?
I agree that race is still very much a determining factor in how individuals be treated in the criminal justice system, okay, throughout all parts of it. I agree it absolutely is a determining factor, okay? I strive to make it not a determining factor, but my question to you is other than what people within the system are trying to do to change it, what is your alternative? What do you want to do? How do we change it? Do we come up with a new system?
In terms of what? You've made a grand general statement, and you've asked a general question, but I need specifics because, you know, there's all kind of things that someone can do, and some of the things I suggest might not be as pleasant as you would like for them to be. So you have to give me something specific.
Okay, so do we get rid of police officers?
I would think that there is a good probability, especially as a black man living in Wyandotte County, that there's a fairly good number of police officers on the police force right now that aren't fit to be paid by the taxpayers as protectors. Yeah, so I think that a lot of police officers basically need to be gotten rid of.
No, I'm talking about
replaced by people that have had really extensive psychological testing to find out beforehand, before they get to situations where it's a matter of life and death in seconds, whether they're going to do something ethical, you know, afterwards or beforehand, or whether they're just going to follow the routine.
Okay, and so you agree that we should have police. It's just a question of who should serve on the police force and how those persons should be vetted. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's only part of what you're hearing.
Okay.
You're really not hearing what's being stated.
And what is being stated?
And it's nonverbal. There are a lot of people that at this point will never get behind believing that there is any sort of justice that will ever be measured out or even considered for a black person when they're charged with a crime. A good case in point, since you brought it up earlier, is the case in Ferguson. There's no way in bleep that if I had gone there as a black man, shot somebody white, whether I was wearing a uniform or not, that I would not have been indicted or charged right this very second and sitting in a jail for murder. No way. You know that. I know that. There's a lot of pretty words you're probably going to say after this, but it won't negate that fact, and it won't negate that feeling that pretty much every black American that's paid attention to that particular case feels at this point. So there's plenty of things that can be done, but will they be done? Is it possible for them to be done? I don't know. I think that if you're constantly fighting against a racist system that has endless funds and endless minions with guns that will go out and do their bidding, that you're probably up against a pretty tough enemy. Sit around and just chat about it really doesn't do much.
I have a question for you myself, caller. Do you seriously believe that even if Darren Wilson was indicted for the murder of Michael Brown, that that would solve all of the other racial issues that, I mean,
No.
Okay.
No, he's like a pimple.
Okay.
On a diseased pig.
Right. If you excuse my little description.
I agree with you 100%.
He's nothing. He's nothing. He just sees something that does their bidding. We all know the police are here for control. Now, we have to figure out who are they really trying to control. And we all know that there's different policing tactics nationwide for different populations. We know this. We know this because we know that when the police serve warrants in Jackson County, I'm sure they don't show up with an armored truck, 15 guys with assault rifles and body armor, and kick the door in and hold everybody at gunpoint to the floor. But they do that routinely in Kansas City, Missouri, in Kansas City, Kansas. And they don't do that all over the city, only in the areas that are populated by people that are non-white. Bottom line.
Well, I certainly can't argue with you. We are almost out of time, and we do thank you for calling in.
Yeah, and I thank you for the opportunity to actually say the things that people keep walking up to that line, but they won't say. No. We know what the problem is in this country. It's just a matter of picking up your gonad off the floor and going at the problem. That's all it is. But it's not going to happen because there's way too many races in this country, and they seek the whole positions of decision-making and authority, which is bizarre. The only way that could be possible in a democracy would be that perhaps the people that elect them, maybe they might be racist in some way, shape, or form.
Okay,
there's
thank
always
you.
That possibility.
All right, thank you, caller, for calling in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller.
All right. Dave, could you give us your contact information right quick before we go off the air?
Sure. If you need to reach me, the best way to do that is by email, dbell, B-E-L-L, at whmlaw.net. Dbell at whm as in Mary, law.net.
All right. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Those who believe in drug war believe it eternally necessary to empower our terrorist enemies daring enough to farm the flowers we forbid. They believe they need to forever enrich barbarous Latin cartels that terrorize millions of innocents as they corrupt civilization itself. Their mandate to themselves and the world ensures tens of thousands of gangs roam our neighborhoods with high-powered weapons, enticing our children to lives of crime and addiction. They believe these tactics necessary to destroy the terrorists, to eliminate the cartels, and to dissuade the gangs from the annual sale of $100 billion worth of drugs to our children. They believe they will never have to defend their tactics or explain the horrible flaws in their plan. Quite obviously, those who believe in drug war do not believe in public safety. 100 years of drug war is quite enough. December 17th will mark 100 years since the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act, the first major prohibition of drugs in the U.S. Our goal is to have rallies at noon on this date in front of hundreds of U.S. courthouses featuring defense attorneys, judges, pastors, and members of LEAP, SSDP, DPA, and many others. We will invite local police chiefs, sheriffs, and district attorneys to defend this policy if they have a mind to. To learn more, please visit endprohibition.org. Do it for the children. Nearly every day we gather more organizations willing to stand with these defense attorneys, including the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, End Mass Incarceration, National African American Forum, Republicans Against Marijuana Prohibition, California Normal, Citizens Opposing Prohibition, Mothers Act for Criminal Justice Reform, These attorneys and organizations seek a new paradigm wherein drug users are no longer arrested for minor amounts of drugs and where compassion, education, and acceptance replace arrests, mandatory minimums, and lifelong stigma. Please gather at your courthouse at noon on Wednesday, December 17th to challenge the drug war. And be sure to invite the local sheriff, police chief, and district attorney to come to this rally to defend this policy of everlasting drug war. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio. Not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, KKFI.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Plan for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beauticious Blues with Luscious Lynn. And at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon. And Eco Radio, KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Music.
Smile on my face. Lord, I'm gonna teach myself how to understand. Okay.